I'm letting the music resolve again.
There you go.
Yeah, it's
nice resolution.
Yeah, there we go. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Well, we left you hanging with an explanation of who did it. Was it God or Satan who tempted or prompted David to take a census that it was wrong to take? And one coming from the second book of Samuel, the other one coming from the First Chronicles, two different tellings. And you were in the midst of telling us you've done a study of the use of that word.
So historically, I've used the resolution of saying, okay, so really what's happening here is God allows the devil, Satan, to tempt David, and then there are these consequences. But I've been doing this study of how Hebrew uses the term Satan, and which just means adversary. Mm-hmm. And even though it's clear in the New Testament that Satan, capital S, is a single figure that is the leader of the demonic forces, when you look at the Old Testament use of the term Satan, it's not being used that way. Sometimes it's used of human beings in a perfectly ordinary sense of this man is your adversary. He's your Satan, which is, you know, adversary, Satan, same thing. In other passages, Satan is used of a supernatural figure. But when it's used for a specific one, it tends to have the Hebrew definite article, ha, which is the Hebrew equivalent of the word the in front of it. So you'll have ha-satan, the Satan.
Okay.
And you see this, for example, in the book of Daniel, where you've got this scene in heaven in Daniel 1, where God is in his heavenly temple, his throne room, and all of the sons of God, which are high-ranking angelic beings that form the divine council, they come in, and also ha-satan comes in. And God says, where have you been? What you've been doing? And he says, well, I've been walking up and down on the earth and looking at stuff. And that's his job. He's the ha-satan, the Satan in this case, is an official in God's heavenly court who is essentially the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
It's his job to look up and down on earth for humans doing bad stuff and report them back to God.
Mm-hmm.
That's his job. So he's been doing his job. And God says, have you noticed my servant Job? Isn't he awesome? And at this point, the prosecutor, the Satan, the adversary, challenges God and says, oh, he's a fair weather friend. He only seems nice because you've blessed him. Take away his blessings and he'll curse you to your face. And so is it good for a prosecutor to challenge God's judgment on something?
No.
No. So this is a bad guy. Even though he's an official in the heavenly court, he's also a bad guy. And that's why the New Testament picks up on this and makes him depicts him as the leader of the demonic forces. He is, but he also has this other function in God's overall plan, as we see in the book of Job. But what do we find when we look at the passage in First Chronicles that says a Satan or someone, some Satan, opposed Israel and caused David to take a census? There's no definite article. It says Satan, not ha-Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not clearly the definite figure that we find in Job or in the prophets. Instead, There's only one other place in the Old Testament where you have Satan used for a supernatural figure with no definite article. And you know who it is on that occasion?
Mm-mm.
The angel of the Lord.
Oh.
This is in Numbers 22, which is where you have the account of Balaam, the Canaanite prophet. And he's been summoned to like curse Israel, and he's traveling down the road with his donkey, and the angel of the Lord appears in the road ahead of him. He doesn't see the angel of the Lord, but the donkey does, and the donkey stops, and so Balaam starts beating on the donkey, and the angel then manifests and says, "Don't beat your donkey just saved your life." Because I would have killed you if she hadn't stopped, and because I'm here as your Satan, I'm here as your adversary, And so you have the angel of the Lord being described as Satan, as an adversary of Balaam. And there's no definite article here. So he's an adversary of Balaam. And the angel of the Lord, if you look in other passages, is often identified, the angel of Yahweh, that's what it Lord is in these passages. So this is the angel of Yahweh. You look in other passages, and there is a blurring of the identity of the angel of Yahweh and Yahweh himself. That's why you'll have various passages like the sacrifice of Isaac in Genesis, and there'll be an angel that calls out to Abraham and says something, and then it'll say, and Yahweh said. Right. And you have this interesting mixing of it being described as the angel of Yahweh or just Yahweh himself. There's this blending of the two figures, and that's led in later centuries around Jesus' time to what's called the two powers in heaven doctrine, that you have Yahweh and the second Yahweh. Mm-hmm. And so there's an awareness of some kind of plurality in the Godhead. Well, the only two passages in the Old Testament where you have Satan without the definite article referring to a supernatural figure are Numbers 22, where it's the angel of Yahweh, and 1 Chronicles 21. Guess who's also in 1 Chronicles 21? After David takes the census, God sends a plague, and who is administering the plague? It's the angel of Yahweh.
Oh, okay, so he's the adversary.
And so there is a significant case to be made that it is the angel of Yahweh slash Yahweh that is the adversary of Israel. Mm-hmm. In this passage. And so I am not at a point where I can say that's the definite solution.
Right.
But by your sin, you can make Yahweh your adversary, and even though he loves you. There's another sense in which you can make Yahweh your adversary. And there's a good argument to be made that that's what's happening in these two passages, that because of its sins, Israel has made Yahweh its adversary. And so David ends up taking this sentence that provides the occasion for Yahweh to judge Israel.
Thank you so much for that question, Marino. Appreciate it. Very well articulated. It's Internet Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and all the questions have come from the Internet. This one comes from Charles. Must we wait for someone to be declared venerable or a servant of God before praying for their canonization and or intercession?
So in terms of their canonization, no. You can pray for someone's canonization at any time you want. I could pray for your canonization right now, Cy Kellett. You know, I mean, just because you're not dead yet doesn't mean God won't remember my prayer once you are dead.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, he's omniscient. And so he would definitely remember that I was praying for your canonization even before you died. So you can do that at any time you want. In terms of intercession, well, since you're not dead yet, you're not in heaven. I mean, I could ask for your intercession right now.
Sure.
You know, and you could intercede on earth for me. You couldn't intercede in heaven since you're not there yet.
Thank you for putting the yet on there.
Although you might remember that when you are in heaven, you might remember that I asked all those years ago.
Oh, that's true. Right. Yeah.
You know?
Right.
But no, even with intercession, you don't have to wait for someone to be canonized. You can ask for, let's say your spouse dies.
Yeah.
You can immediately ask your spouse to pray for you on the other side. Whether they're in purgatory or heaven, it doesn't matter. They can talk to God just like you can. Now, there is a limitation on the circumstances in which you do this. If you're, let's say, at church and you're doing a litany of the saints, so you're asking different saints in heaven for their intercession, they have to be at least a blessed. So for the public invocation of saints, public meaning as part of an official church function.
Got it. Yeah.
If you're doing it as part of an official function, like a worship service, the person you're asking for their intercession has to be either blessed or fully canonized as a saint. But privately or in church, but unofficially, you can ask anybody you want for their intercession.
Charles, thanks very much for the question. It's time for our first break this hour. We'll come back with more internet questions for Jimmy Akin on this Internet Open Forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
When Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ, he once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
I wasn't trying to let the music resolve. I had a little cough in my throat there. Sorry. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's an internet open forum. All kinds of great questions from the internet. This one comes from Christian. Jimmy, what are your secrets to success as an apologist? And what are the blessings and challenges of an apologist?
Okay. So one resource I can mention that you could get more detail than what I'll be able to give here on the show is the Introduction to Apologetics course I did for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics, because I talk about apologetic method and how to do it and things like that. And that's sort of some of the secrets of success. But basically, the secrets of success that I try to use in general terms are threefold. The first is be very precise about what's true. So that's making sure I know the answer.
Okay.
And that I'm fair and that I'm not biasing it towards, I'm not biasing the evidence in some way. I try to be very precise about what the evidence is and try to make sure I'm right. So I try in whatever I say. So that's kind of the first aspect of it. I also, the second is I try to be very precise in how I communicate it. So I don't want to mislead people by being sloppy in how I say things or by putting my thumb on the scale. I want to be very fair and balanced in how I present things and open-minded. And then the third is I want to be charitable towards not just my position or the position of people who agree with me, but also towards the people who disagree with me. I want to treat them with the same respect I want. I try to apply the golden rule. And really, the golden rule is the key to it all. Because if someone is trying to convince me of something, I would want them to be very charitable, including towards my current view, whatever it may be on a topic, and I would want them to be very precise, and I would want them to be very careful in making sure they're using accurate evidence. And if I want them to do that when they're trying to convince me of something, I need to do those things when I'm trying to convince them of something.
Yeah.
In terms of, so the golden rule is the master key.
Yeah.
As it is in every area of life. In terms of blessings and challenges, well, I get the blessing of the joy of discovery.
Yeah.
Because I love learning new things. You know, Richard Feynman, the physicist, has a book called The Pleasure of Finding Things Out. And I love finding things out. I'm very blessed to be able to work in this career that allows me to constantly be learning new things. So I have the joy of discovery. And then I have the joy of teaching, of communicating that information to others and experiencing their joy of discovery and hearing from them how the information I've provided has helped them in various ways. And so those are the the primary blessings, the one that I get myself from learning, and then what I experience from others as I'm able to help them. In terms of challenges, the big challenges are being right and being charitable.
Like being right, meaning you've got to do the work in order to get your answer right.
Well, yeah, and phrasing it correctly, and you know, so it's essentially the keys to success. The challenge is employing those.
Yeah, right. Okay, very good, very good. Christian, thank you very much for that question. The next one comes from Bo. Bo asks, can you address the Catholic charismatic renewal and just Pentecostalism, charismaticism in general? I grew up in that and am a little disheartened that it's found its way into the church. How should Catholics like me view the CCR in particular, Catholic Charismatic Renewal in particular, and the charismatic Pentecostal movement more broadly?
So let's talk about the Pentecostal movement, because it's the one that started first historically. Mm-hmm. Now, there have been reports all the way down through history of God giving miraculous gifts to his people. It was apparently very common for that to happen in the first century, not as common in later centuries, but it was still there. Then after the Reformation happened, you had a lot of people in the Protestant community say, the age of miraculous gifts is over. And part of the reason they seem to have done that is because they wanted to undermine Catholic reports of miracles.
Oh.
Because if you have, say, oh, yeah, Saint so-and-so did this, isn't that proof that, like, we should ask the saints for their intercession?
Yeah.
I mean, this person got miraculously healed of cancer because of this saint's intercession. So you had the pressure in the Protestant community, which is trying to distinguish itself from the Catholic community, to say, oh, no, that's not what's happening here. The age of miracles is over. But there's nothing in the Bible that says that.
Yeah.
And that's a problem if you're a Protestant and you want to say there's no more miracles, because you're using sola scriptura, the Bible alone, to form your theology, and there's nothing in the Bible that says this, that there's not going to be any more miracles after the apostolic age. And so that led, particularly in the 19th century here in America, as part of an event known as the Second Great Awakening, for people to question this. And so you'd have in the 19th century these like campfire meetings or camp meetings, revivals going on, and people would be getting really enthusiastic and really excited, and they would claim to be experiencing God's power in their lives in these revival settings. Sometimes they had some rather colorful experiences. I mean, today you'll hear about things like laughing in the spirit and stuff like that. Well, okay, you should get in your TARDIS and go to the 19th century, because they had some really interesting phenomena that they reported. Back in the day, back then, hunting was a big thing. That was how people would often get their meat. So they'd go out with their dogs and they would hunt, let's say, raccoons. Well, if you're a raccoon, you don't want to be hunted. So you might do something like climb a tree to get away from the dogs. And the dogs would then identify the tree you're in, and they'd be barking up the tree at you to let the hunter know where you are. Or, whatever animal they're hunting. Well, so there was a reported experience in 19th century Second Great Awakening revival meetings known as treeing the devil.
Really?
Yeah, where human beings would act like dogs and tree the devil. So there would be a tree, they would perceive the devil up in the tree, and they would like howl at the devil in the tree to intimidate him.
Yeah.
Also, we have these references in Scripture to water baptism, and John the Baptist also talks about being baptized in fire, and there's also discussion of being baptized with the Spirit. Well, there was one guy in the 19th century who had three additional baptisms, not only water baptism, fire baptism, and Spirit baptism, but baptism of oxide, baptism of lyddite, and baptism of dynamite.
Well, I don't want that last one.
It's supposed to be a very powerful spiritual experience.
I bet it would be.
Yeah.
Baptized with dynamite.
Yeah. So there are a lot of interesting phenomena.
Yeah.
But We're not really yet to the Pentecostal movement, but we are in a phase of American religious history where you have people who, for in a new kind of way, are being open to powerful spiritual experiences of a miraculous nature in a way they hadn't been in previous centuries. And so when we come to the 20th century, in 1901, you have, in fact, on like New Year's Day, 1901, you have a woman, you have this group praying, and one of the women in it starts speaking in tongues. And that's considered often the birth of the Pentecostal movement. Mm-hmm. Another early marker that's also sometimes considered the birth of the Pentecostal movement is in 1906, 5 years later. In Los Angeles, there was a church on Azusa Street. Azusa stands for...
I know this. Okay. You told me this before. Yeah. A to Z USA.
A to Z USA, Azusa, right. So on Azusa Street, there was a revival. And speaking in tongues was, and other miraculous gifts like prophecy and healings and stuff were part of that. And so you had this movement start in the Protestant community that tried to bring back some of the spiritual gifts that like St. Paul talks about in Romans 12 and 1 Corinthians 12. And especially 1 Corinthians 12. And this led, now originally this was kind of an outsider movement. This was not happening in regular mainline Protestant churches. And so early Pentecostals started to form their own churches. And that's what gave us churches like the Assemblies of God. That's mm-hmm. the biggest of the Pentecostal churches. But then in the 1960s, you started to have this same phenomena start to spill over into mainline Protestant churches. So you could have Baptists or Methodists or Presbyterians who were reporting experiences like this, or Anglicans and Episcopalians here in the U.S. And that's what the charismatic movement is. It's the reporting of these charismatic spiritual gifts, these miraculous gifts in mainline Protestant churches, not just like off in the Assemblies of God or something. Mm-hmm. And at the same time that happened, it started happening by the late 1960s, it started happening in Catholic churches too. And that's the origin of the Catholic charismatic movement. Now, in terms of what to think about this, well, one of the things the congregation that the Doctrine of the Faith has pointed out is that the Holy Spirit can give new gifts at different points in history. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's a fixed list that the Holy Spirit is confined to.
Right.
And so could the Holy Spirit touch somebody's heart in a spiritual way by letting them tree the devil?
Yeah.
Well, it's not my spirituality, but mm-hmm. I can't rule it out in principle.
Yeah.
On the other hand, do I think everyone who claims in these movements to be speaking in tongues is actually doing so, or that every prophecy they claim to have or every healing they report is genuinely supernatural? Well, I want to be charitable and you know respect their beliefs, but that doesn't mean I need to conclude that.
Yeah.
And so I think that the solution is to heed St. Paul's advice in 1 Thessalonians 5, where he says, don't despise prophesyings, don't quench the Spirit, but test everything and hold fast to what is good. And that's generally the approach that the Catholic Church has taken towards the charismatic renewal in its own ranks.
Right.
Not to dismiss it, but not to just say, oh, everyone needs to be charismatic either. It involves a discernment process, God can reach different people in different ways. For some people to have a charismatic spirituality, that's great. Mm-hmm. If that's how God is reaching you and that helps foster your closeness to Him, that's great. On the other hand, when it comes to particular reports of charismatic phenomena, well, we need to exercise critical thinking. In 1 Corinthians 12 to 14, St. Paul lays down some principles about when and how these gifts are to be used. And those principles are not always followed by all charismatics. Sometimes they use these gifts in situations that St. Paul says don't use them in, or in ways St. Paul says don't use them in. And in terms of is a particular one supernatural or not, well, that's where St. Paul's other dictum from 1 Thessalonians 5 applies. We should be open, but we should also exercise critical thinking and look at the evidence and inform ourselves that way to the extent we need to form a conclusion. Now, if someone comes to me and says, God's given me a revelation that affects your life, here's this prophecy.
Yeah.
Well, if it affects my life, I may have a greater need to form an opinion about, do I really need to act on this or not?
Right.
But on the other hand, if there's some church somewhere, whether Catholic or not, and they're having prophecies that don't affect me, I don't have a pressing need to form an opinion about that.
Yeah.
I can leave that question open.
Hey, great question. Thank you so much, Bo. We've got more Internet Open Forum coming up with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Love that groovy music. A little bit of groovy Internet Open Forum today with Jimmy Akin. Lots of groovy questions. As a matter of fact, we were just talking at the break about how great the questions are.
Yeah.
People have magnificent questions.
Very interesting ones today.
Yeah. And they all come from the Internet. And you know how the Internet works. There's a lot of different ways they can get the questions to us. And Jimmy gathers them together and we go through them. This next one comes from, let me just make sure I'm on the right one, Dylan. Diane. I apologize, Diane. This one comes from Diane. Is the Catholic Church infallible when canonizing saints?
So there has been a very common opinion and an influential opinion down through a number of centuries that it is, that if the Catholic Church canonizes someone, that they are definitely in heaven, that the Church is protected by infallibility when it makes that determination. Having said that, there is a tension that has emerged because as the Church has reflected on its own infallibility and the circumstances in which, and as a result of that influential opinion, by the way, you'll have some people just say, oh yeah, and move on.
Yeah, right.
There's actually a little more to it because there's this tension. As the Church has reflected on the circumstances in which it can exercise the gift of infallibility, this is something that happened particularly at Vatican I mm-hmm. and at Vatican II and even to some degree subsequent to Vatican II, it's been developing its doctrine of infallibility. You know, it's been trying to figure out specifically, precisely when can this gift be exercised under what conditions. And one of the conditions, now, if it, what the Church's gift of infallibility is for is to be able to proclaim the doctrines of faith and morals that come to us from Christ and the apostles,
right,
and their implications. But there are also things that are closely connected with matters of faith and morals, and the church has discerned that, okay, in some situations, we need to be able to infallibly define something that's not handed down from Christ and the apostles, but is connected in some way with a doctrine of the faith. Like, for example, let's suppose an ecumenical council defined something infallibly. Well, you could come along and say, I don't think that council was ecumenical.
Oh, right.
You know, yeah. So I don't think its definitions are infallible either. And the church would have a need to settle that question. So the church has come to understand, well, we could, even though the fact this council was ecumenical is not something that's been handed down from the apostles. You know, it's not like St. Peter got a revelation of all the future ecumenical councils.
Right. Yeah.
It is closely enough connected with the doctrine that if we need to defend this doctrine that the council defined, we can defend the council's authority in the same way. And that's what's called a dogmatic fact. It's a fact that's related to dogma, even though it's not a dogma itself. And the category of saint canonizations, if they're infallible, well, it wasn't handed down from Christ and the apostles that Joe Brown was a saint. You know, Joe Brown didn't even live in their day.
Yeah.
So it would have to be in the category of dogmatic fact, not part of the deposit of revelation. And, okay, so as the church has studied this question, it's looked at, well, what are the conditions under which a church can define a dogmatic fact? It can't define just any fact, you know, like,
oh, yeah.
This microbe causes this disease.
Yeah.
That's not connected to dogma enough. That's a matter of science. It's not a dogmatic fact. It's just a fact. And the answer that the magisterium has come up with in recent decades is that in order to be able to define something as a dogmatic fact, it must have a necessary connection with a dogma so that you have to be able, in order to properly defend the dogma, you have to be able to define that fact. Otherwise, it's just a fact. It's not closely connected with dogma enough. And so that brings us to the question of saint canonizations, because what a saint canonization means is someone died in a state of grace and they're in heaven. Is it necessary to defend some dogma that we know Joe Brown is in heaven, that he was in a state of grace at the moment he died?
No, it's not.
It doesn't seem obvious, does
right.
it?
No.
Now, you can argue, well, it somehow defends the church's holiness, but that's somehow defends or somehow amplifies or relates is not the criterion the magisterium has set out. There needs to be a necessary connection.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem obviously necessary that a particular person was in a state of grace at the moment he died. It doesn't seem necessary to know that to be able to defend a doctrine, to defend a dogma. And so that has led some quite orthodox Catholic theologians like Avery Dulles, who was appointed a cardinal because of his theological contributions, to question whether saint canonizations are actually infallible. Now, it's still a very, very common opinion that they are infallible, and some very highly influential theologians think so. But I think there's also a question about it. And even very orthodox Catholic theologians like Cardinal Dulles have raised a question of, hey, it doesn't seem obvious that we really need to know this, that someone died in a state of grace in order to defend a dogma.
Right. Right. And not being infallible wouldn't mean it's therefore wrong.
It doesn't mean
wrong.
They're not in heaven.
Yeah,
no,
right.
They could very well be in heaven.
Right.
And
but it's just a different standard of certainty.
Yeah.
Yeah. This next one comes from Jorge. It's got a Vatican address on it. No, just kidding. It's not from Jorge in the Vatican. Why is the Novus Ordo preferred or superior to the traditional Latin Mass? Is it really an improvement?
Well, I guess the first thing to say is that not everybody is going to agree that the Novus Ordo or the current rite of Mass is to be preferred or is superior to the traditional Latin Mass. And the church doesn't teach that. So that's a matter of opinion. The church doesn't have teachings about this form of liturgy is intrinsically better than some other form.
Right.
The church has a bunch of different liturgies and its different rites. And in when the Council Fathers met at Vatican II and endorsed a liturgical reform, what they were they weren't saying the old rite of Mass was bad. They were just saying it's not as well adapted for today's environment as it could be.
Yeah.
And so we want to better adapt it. And they then authorized a liturgical reform, which took place after the council and actually deviated from what the council called for. So there's even another reason you could say, hey, I don't think that certainly the council did not give its blessing to everything that then happened
right,
as yeah. part of the liturgical reform. Now, ultimately, Paul VI endorsed the results of that reform, although there is apparently, and you know, in conversations, he later said he, in essence, that he discovered he'd been misled. Mm-hmm. That like he was told, there was this one guy, his name was Annibale Bonini, who was the head of the reform after the council. And Bonini was the contact point between the consultors who were revising the liturgy and Paul VI, who was giving the approval. And based on, after the reform was implemented, Paul VI would talk to, I don't think it was Louis Bouillet, but it was someone who was among the consultors.
Yeah.
And he would say, why were you guys so concerned that we do X in the reform, Paul VI would say.
Yeah.
And the consultor he was talking to, who's a very famous theologian, said, well, we only approved that because Bonini told us you wanted it approved.
Oh. So.
And Paul VI would say, Bonini told me that all of you were unanimous that this needed to be approved.
It's like the Parent Trap.
Where, okay.
Do you know what the Parent Trap is?
The movie, yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it.
So you tell one parent that the other parent said this, yeah. and then you tell the other parent that
exactly.
this parent said this. Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's evidence that Bonini maliciously manipulated or self-servingly or whatever and manipulated the reform.
Yeah.
So there's room for criticism here. And even regardless of how we got it, how we got the current rite, it is a holy rite. It is a genuine way of worshiping God. Different people may have different opinions about, because we don't all have the same spirituality, and that's fine. Different people may have different opinions about which form of liturgy makes them get closer to God. They can have different opinions about, hey, maybe we should tweak this or tweak that. They can have different devotions, private devotions that they find helpful. We don't all have to be the same, and what we should do is be charitable to people of all persuasions, because we're not all made the same, and we don't all have to have the same preferences, and that's okay. We shouldn't be looking down on each other as like, oh, I'm a Novus Ordo Catholic, not one of you trads, or I'm a traditional Latin Mass Catholic, not one of you Novus Ordo people, or I'm a Byzantine and I'm better than any of you Latins. None of that is helpful. None of that is spiritual. We should all respect the diversity of rites that exist within the church, and we should thank God that we have them and that we have people who are getting closer to God by them.
Amen, brother. All right, Jorge, thanks for the question. It's break time. We'll take a quick break and come right back with more Internet Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live, internet open forum today. Hey, we've got that store-wide sale continuing. Everything's on sale, 10 to 25% off. Some stuff up to 50% off. Some stuff more than 50% off. Just go to shop.catholic.com and find all the savings. Part of that deal is it includes $5 bulk shipping. So whatever you buy, just it's $5 shipping within the contiguous United States. Let's go to Stephen's question for Jimmy Akin. In 1 Corinthians 5:11, we are told not to associate with a publicly scandalous person who identifies himself or herself as a Christian, to not even eat with such a person. Is that a command to be taken straightforwardly and applied today? Are we really to not eat with such folks?
So I love this passage, and for a reason that may not be obvious. St. Paul wrote two letters to the Corinthians that are in the New Testament. We call them 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. But we know he wrote other letters. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways we know that is in this passage, because Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, "Now I wrote you not to associate with an immoral person." Mm-hmm. So he's referring back to a letter that he wrote that is not in the New Testament and that came before 1 Corinthians. So he's talking about something he wrote in 0th Corinthians.
0th Corinthians.
Yeah.
Corinthians.
And so I love it for that reason, because we get a reference to 0th Corinthians.
Yeah.
But he's clarifying what he said there, because he said, don't, you know, consort with an immoral person. And they like wondered, well, how are we going to do that when all of these people around us are, you know, here in Corinth? I mean, there are these idolaters and they're pagans and they're worshiping idols and they're doing stuff they shouldn't with their bodies. And I've got to get food somewhere.
Yeah.
I got to go to work. You know, how can I not associate with these people? And Paul writes back and he says, I didn't mean non-believers. Because otherwise you would have to go out of the world, you know. So he said, I didn't mean them. I meant someone who bears the name of a brother, someone who claims to be a Christian and is nevertheless an idolater or an adulterer or mm-hmm. something like that. Don't consort with them and don't even eat with them. Well, so eating with someone he's talking. The reason he says that is twofold. He doesn't want to scandalize other people in the Christian community. Like if they see you, if they know you're holding table fellowship, which was a big thing in their culture, you know, if you ate off the same table, that was a sign of respect and agreement and we're in fellowship and stuff. So in their culture, if you're holding table fellowship with someone who is a known idolater and is nevertheless claiming to be a Christian, that can scandalize other Christians who are only recent ex-idolaters. And they could think, well, maybe it's okay for a Christian to commit idolatry or something like that, or adultery, or whatever it may be. And we know they had temptations along those lines in the Corinthian church. In fact, this is one of the passages that pertains to that. So he says, you know, don't do it in that situation. Also, it can scandalize the person. If you if you invite someone over to hold table fellowship with you and they're an idolater Christian, and you don't do anything else, it's going to tend to confirm them
in their
idolatry.
Right.
So that's what he's envisioning. He's not envisioning other circumstances, like I invite the idolater over to try to talk him out of his idolatry.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
So Paul's not talking about that. But and so as a result, we shouldn't look at this as if it's a ironclad law that's to be used in all circumstances.
Right.
It is not. But the principle here is relevant to our own day. God forbid, let's suppose you, Cy Kellett,
yes,
were, well, let's turn it around. Mm-hmm. Let's suppose, God forbid, that I, Jimmy Akin, while professing to be a Catholic apologist, nevertheless started worshiping an idol of Odin.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Would that have, would that justifiably have an impact on your and my relationship and whether we get together for dinner?
Oh, yes. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. This is a problem that needs to be addressed.
Exactly.
It can't just be treated as if everything just goes on normally.
Exactly. Same thing if you, God forbid, while professing to be a Catholic, then started worshiping an idol of Apollo.
Yeah.
It would have an impact on our relationship, and I wouldn't just be going out to dinner with you like it was normal.
Right.
This is a horrendous thing that's happened. It needs to be addressed. We can't just have normal, friendly relations in this kind of circumstance.
Right.
And so that's the underlying principle that that Paul is getting at, and he's giving it a particular application that is similar to, but not necessarily identical with, the application it would have in our culture. But when you have something gravely immoral that is publicly known and that has not been repented of by a fellow Christian, it absolutely should have an impact on your relationship with that person, lest you give scandal to that person or others in the Christian community.
Stephen, thank you. Thank you very much for the question. It's an internet open forum. And now a question from Pat. How old was Jesus really when he died? Seems like he might have been as old as 37.
Well, so there's not a church teaching on how old Jesus was. This is a matter that the church leaves to scholars to figure out. I've done a considerable amount of study on this, and I have written about it, and we may in the show notes have a couple of links to articles I've written that cover this.
Okay.
One of them is and you could also Google them, but one of them is called What Year Was Jesus Born? The Answer May Surprise You. The other is called Seven Clues Tell Us Precisely When Jesus Died.
So I'm just pointing at Darren. Yeah, we'll put them in the show notes. Yeah.
Okay. So based on my study of this subject, Jesus was born in the year 3/2 BC. What that means is the back half of the year 3 BC or the front half of the year 2 BC. Mm-hmm. That's indicated by evidence in the Gospels, particularly Luke, and it's also the year identified by the vast majority of the church fathers that address the question.
Okay.
Now, what about his birthday? Well, this is much harder. We don't have the kind of evidence I would want to be able to say precisely what his birthday in that year was. However, based on the current state of my research, if I had to pick a date, mm-hmm. it would be September 11th, 3 BC.
Really?
Yeah. And there is a reason for that. That's based on the sign in heaven that John sees in Revelation 12. If you interpret it as an actual configuration of the sky with a woman with the sun in her midst and the moon at her feet and so forth, okay, that's Virgo. And when would this arrangement of celestial figures have been there as seen from Jerusalem? And this is connected with Jesus' birth in Revelation 12. Well, it would have been September 11, 3 BC.
Whoa.
So there is an argument to be made. It is not obvious that this is what John is doing.
Sure.
But it does fit mm-hmm. The data that we have. So I'll just estimate it as September 11th, 3 BC, which means 2 years and about 4 months before we get to January 1st, AD 1. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then when does Jesus die? Well, that I'm very confident of, April 3rd, AD 33. We have really good evidence for that. And so that would be 32 years and 3 months since January 1st of AD 1. So you take the 2 years and 4 months and the 32 years in 3 months, put them together, you get 34 years in about 7 months. And that is the best estimate I can give on exactly how old Jesus was when he was crucified, 34 years in about 7 months.
I have to just ask you this, because mm-hmm. we're going to do it soon. Then how do we end up with December 25th as the day we celebrate the birth? I mean, no, but I know that we're
Here's a possibility.
Yeah.
So the September 11th in 3 BC was the Jewish New Year, and by the civil calendar. And the two dates that you get, December 31st and January 6th, which are in Western and Eastern Christendom, are the main proposed dates, are also tightly conjoined to the turn of the year.
Okay.
And so there may have been a memory from Jewish circles that Jesus was born at the Jewish New Year that then Gentiles applied to the Gentile New Year.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And so that may have been what led to those two different dates that are both like a week from New Year's Day.
Okay. All right. So
that's one possibility.
Yeah. Let's go to Dylan. I think we have time to get Dylan's.
Okay.
Too scared.
Yeah, we do.
Too scared to check, but how did Noah's family reproduce or procreate if everyone's gone?
Well, Noah's family, assuming you're taking the text literally and assuming that there's nobody else alive on Earth. And by the way, if you want more on all that, check out Mysterious World, because I did a two-parter on just this question on how we understand Noah and the flood. And what the options are. But if we assume that only eight people survived in the entire world, it was Noah, Noah's wife, Noah's sons, three sons, and the sons' wives. Mm-hmm. So, well, they would have procreated. Mm-hmm. And there was no incest involved in that. And then in the generation after that, you would have the children of Noah's sons. Mm-hmm. And because there were three sons, and that meant that you had cousins. And so Noah's children, grandchildren, would have married their cousins, which is something that can happen. It is not, it's not automatically immoral to marry a cousin. It can happen.
Yeah.
And in this situation, it would have needed to happen. And then in the generation after that, you've got even further diversification of the family line, and you wouldn't even need to marry your cousins. You could marry people who were more distantly related. And so this is a situation unlike the situation with Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, where you don't have to marry your sister. You can marry a cousin or someone more distant than that.
That one, I think I said Dylan again, and that was Diane.
Diane.
Like, I don't know why I keep putting an L in Diane's name.
Well,
sorry about that.
You're interpolating. And that's actually not unexpected, because the way we process words, you know, when we're learning to read, we're taught to sound them out letter by letter.
Yeah.
But that's not how we actually do it in practice. The way we do it in practice is we look at the front of the word. We do this subconsciously, but we look at the front of the word and we look at the end of the word and we infer what the word is. So if you look at the front of Diane and the end of Diane...
Looks like Dylan.
It's easy to interpolate an L in the middle of it.
Yeah, because Diane spells her name with a Y, by the way, as well.
Yeah.
I have found as I have gotten older, I'm a less precise reader as far as like... I think my brain is doing a lot of like filling in and without... pausing on words as much. And sometimes that's a very successful strategy for your brain, but sometimes then you're like, oh, I misread that.
Well, I don't know that that's age-related. It could be, but that happens to everybody, because once you start reading and you're familiar with the vast majority of the words you're going to encounter reading, you use the first-last principle.
Yeah. Sorry about that, Diana. That turned you into Dylan twice in one show, I think. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World drops tomorrow. Tell us again what's on tomorrow.
Life on Mars.
Life on Mars. So for all of you David Bowie's fans, Life on Mars. Well, it's not about the David Bowie song.
Not about. I do mention the David Bowie song.
Okay. All right. That does it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.